The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Aaron Leonard is a writer and historian. He is a regular contributor to Truth Out, Ravel.ca, The History News Network, Physics World, and Canadian Dimension Magazine. His book, Heavy Radicals, was published by Zero Books in February of this year, and he returns to the podcast to talk about COINTELPRO and American Maoism. Joshua Mofawad Paul reviewed the book in Marx and Philosophy Review of Books. He said, Leonard and Gallagher's historiography reads as a grand political tragedy. It is a story of an organization that, despite significant state interference, temporarily became the primary force of revolution in the United States, and then, almost despite state interference, imploded and became a marginal grouplet. It's Wednesday, the 11th of November, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear a cut-up of a documentary on Mao, a songified speech from Bob Avakian, and Andrew Kleiman and Raya Dunyanskaya explaining the negation of the negation. Right now, you're listening to the March of the Volunteers, but in just a moment, you'll be hearing from Aaron Leonard as we discuss the history of some heavy radicals.
I mean, the left is like, Norman Mailer had this wonderful quote in Armies of the Night about when the Communist Party kind of, as it entered the 60s, it had been smashed into a million tiny fragments. So that's kind of how the left is today. And the more I get out and talk to people, it doesn't seem like anybody's just people. Everybody's kind of associated with something. All these little trends and identities and groups and grouplets. It's just, I don't know that it's good.
It doesn't sound good when you say it like that, but move words around, you can make anything sound bad. No. It is the case that everybody tends to be associated with an ideology or an argument. But also, I think people don't really know their own arguments very well often enough. They're associated with a group more than they are with an idea. At least that's my complaint. I'd prefer to have people say, I'm a Maoist, and here's what Mao meant, and argue it out, rather than say, I'm with Bob Avakian's group, and this is what we believe. Maybe I'm bourgeois that way.
I don't think that's bourgeois. I think that's Marxism-Leninism has had a very bad track record with the intelligentsia, and that's telling. The intelligentsia, they can be obnoxious, but they're doing important work. Some of them are doing shit work, but, some of them are doing important work. As far as advancing humanity's understanding of itself and the world it inhabits, you can't just kick those folks to the side. You really need those people right in there, asking the tough questions. The good ones do that, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And I know Marx's vision was that everyone would be a part of the intelligentsia eventually, and also, a poet in the afternoon.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because a lot of people are in, well, not a lot, but people in these Marxist-Leninist groups, I don't think they quite get that Marx was an intellectual. I mean, he really would have thrown out his ideas if they just didn't hold up to, you know, evidentiary scrutiny. I mean, that is my sense, which is not to say he was free from any shortcomings, but he was able to do what he was able to do on the basis of being kind of wide open to what he would discover. At least.
Can we leave this bit in about Marx and all that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. So your book, Heavy Radicals, it came out early on this year, February 27th. It's done well for us at Zero since then. And you've continued to speak about it and to talk to people about it. And you've continued to do research on the themes of Heavy Radicals around Maoism in the 60s through the 80s. So what have you found out since the book's come out?
Well, you know, we're pulling on a lot of threads. I mean, one thing is, I think what was we felt, you know, when I say we, I'm talking about Connor Gallagher, who is younger than I am, but he did a lot of the path-breaking research. He ended up kind of on a mission to get these Freedom of Information documents from the FBI. And, you know, what we've discovered is, I tell this story. I think back when I was a radical political activist, we dreamed of the day when, you know, we held the reins of power and we would be able to go through the archives of the FBI and such and reveal all these secrets. And ironically, you know, there's an element of we are going through those archives and, you know, we don't have anything, you know, approaching state power, but, you know, kind of given the twists and turns of the U.S. government and the FBI and, you know, the mandates it's subject to. And, you know, the passage of time meant that a lot of stuff unavailable is now available. And we're discovering, you know, a great deal. I mean, we discovered, you know, that this group, the Revolutionary Union, Revolutionary Communist Party, which started in 1968, was infiltrated from the very beginning. And now as we continue to do that, we discovered that it was part of a doctrine by the FBI, which was to try to penetrate, if you will, organizations when they're forming up, you know, or when they're in real disarray, and which is exactly what they did. They had an informant on the regional executive committee of this group in the Bay Area by its third meeting in 1968. They had a woman informant actually be part of the forming study group in Washington, D.C., you know, with the point of her trying to get into a leadership position. And that actually fell apart before it evolved. In Louisiana, and I think that's right, they had this couple, Jill and G. Schaefer, who they wanted to try to, you know, be instrumental in getting in leadership of a forming revolutionary union cell down there. That didn't work out so well either. So, but time after time, this is actually a doctrine, and it's, you know, it's savvy and it's illuminating. So we're learning more about that. We are pressing on about, you know, some people who we suspected might be informants. We're trying to actually get to the point where we can say that more definitively. That's going to require some work, because a lot of what you see in the FBI memos is big uppercase commands at the top of the memo. This is sensitive information. Everything must be parsed and paraphrased so as not to reveal, you know, a vital source and such. So that's a lot of what we're learning. And, you know, one thing opens another door. So, you know, but there's quite a bit of work left to do.
The one moment is the destruction of the old. That's the first negation. But the simple point is that that's not enough for the creation of a new society. And that's very unappreciated still to this day. Her whole political project became keeping these two moments together. She called it the destruction of the old and the creation of the new. That was, in a sense, her political translation. Second negation is the absolute. I mean, in philosophy, absolute means not relative, not conditioned by something else. Something is relative, it's conditioned by something else. Something that's absolute is not conditioned by something else. Whereas the revolution against capitalism is obviously conditioned by exploitation, oppression, domination. It's conditioned by capitalism. The positive element, the creation of the new, is unconditioned. It's a free creative act, and it has its own dialectic. It's not just the dialectic of fighting against capitalism. It does not flow naturally from the conditions that we face.
And the word is revolution impermanent. You have so many, you the revolutionaries, the ones who did it, for heaven's sake, have so many prejudices, have been so brainwashed by the society it is, from language to class countries to anything, that you have no idea on how you have to reorganize yourself to have these new human relations. You have just set the ground.
You say the FBI is infiltrating groups as they're starting. What did the FBI think it was doing? In other words, what was their mission? Were they protecting the country from outside influence and, you know, from communist China and from the Soviet Union? Was that what they thought their mission was when they were infiltrating these groups? That these
This was very serious for them. Their investigation of the Revolutionary Union and groups like Progressive Labor Party were technically labeled internal security investigations. Congress had the former House Un-American Activities Committee was renamed the House Internal Security Committee. So these groups are set up to basically undermine domestic organizations that have a strategic long-term plan to make a communist revolution. And this strategy evolved around the Communist Party, USA, particularly in the 50s. That's where the famous COINTELPRO operation actually began. COINTELPRO is short for counterintelligence program, which is not just monitoring an organization, but trying to undermine it. You know, and the COINTELPRO started as one campaign against the Communist Party USA, and it evolved to target black hate groups, is what they called black nationalists and revolutionary nationalist forces, Puerto Rican forces, the New Left, etc. What they were trying to do, and this is very interesting because there's a difference between the way they grow after groups that are popularly referred to as terrorists and groups like the Revolutionary Union. I mean, groups that are more political or sending people into factories that have a long-term plan are not something the FBI can just go up and arrest people. I mean, there are laws in this country, and people can argue whether or not these groups ought to be able to advocate what they do. But in the 60s, the Supreme Court had said you could advocate this stuff, and it wasn't illegal. But the FBI was basically trying to make these groups work difficult, but they were also trying to have a database of information so that when the necessary moment came, they could arrest the leadership and basically hobble the groups. I mean, and this was actually something that had come about just before World War II with the passage of the Smith Act, where it made it a crime to advocate the government. You know, that law was modified in the 60s. But so the FBI they're doing two things. They're actively trying to undermine group by, you know, spreading rumors, getting informants to pit groups against each other or the group against itself. But they're also, you know, following people so every 6 months they know where the leaders live so that they can just go and arrest them, you know, if the time is right. So there's method there. It's not just like the FBI is just, we don't like this, so we're going to just attack it. They, you know, had in mind to destroy these groups for the national interest, you know, that these groups, you know, were self-proclaimed enemies of American democracy and the American government. And, you know, it was the duty of the FBI to keep them in check. So that's their mission, and they followed it out.
Did the FBI think of these domestic groups as being purely domestic? Or, you know, did they think of these? I guess the other way I could think of asking this is, did the FBI see these groups as forming out of the working classes or from coming out of poverty or the, you know, those who have been left out of society? Or did they think of these groups as some sort of international threat, even though they were domestically formed?
I think they were a combination. I mean, they, with the Revolutionary Union, it had ties to Mao's China. It had, you know, it was, you know, it had, it advocated or popularized what was going on in the Chinese Revolution. The FBI labeled, no pun intended, the one of the founders of the group labeled Bergman as a Chinese communist agent, though they never arrested him on espionage charge or you know, traitorous behavior. But in the documents, he's referred to in their language as a Chi-Com agent. So they, you know, and when you label somebody a foreign agent like that, it really does allow the government to bring the full weight of its secret police apparatus against you. I mean, this is, you know, clearly the national interest is being challenged in their view if you are working in the interest of an antagonistic foreign government. But the, also the FBI was clear that this was a domestic group. And they were clear, too, that it was mainly came out of students. But, you know, your question is good because, you know, these mainly white students went into factories. And, you know, some of the people in factories were these angry kids who had just kind of come up out of the 60s situation. It was Vietnam vets who had come back to get a job in the steel mills or the smelters. And these communists were talking to these people, or some of these people were communists themselves, these Maoists. And there was quite a bit of work. And I think we need to do more research here to try to make divisions so that, you know, that these more organized radicals didn't connect, you know, too fully with these people. But it was a volatile time in the 70s where things were changing, and all this was in the context of the workforce was changing and industry was changing, and you know, neoliberalism was taking hold. Factories were either moving down south or moving to Mexico or, you know, headed toward Asia and stuff. So I think the FBI was mindful of a number of aspects of these things. You know, not all of them. I think some of the street agents probably had a pretty pedestrian view of things. But they did have some, you know, basically intellectual secret police who kind of understood it more from a step back way.
A few years back, I think it could even be as far back as like 5 years ago, in Portland, there was an attempted bombing of our Christmas tree lighting ceremony. And the kid who was supposedly planning on doing this, all of his cohorts were FBI. There was only one person who was not FBI involved in the conspiracy. So they had recruited him. They had set him up to do the bombing. And then they had, at the last moment, you know, replaced the bombs with tissue paper or whatever they did and arrested him, right? So it didn't happen. But the question with that kind of thing is, would anything have happened with this kid if it hadn't been for the FBI? And I have the same question about organizations where you have people involved in their formation. Would these organizations even exist if it hadn't been for the FBI?
Well, you know, I think you kind of have to take it on a case-by-case basis. The Revolutionary Union definitely would have existed without the FBI. And, you know, you can see this memo comes through. It's, you get a sense there's a field agent who has contact with an informant, and they write up a report that this guy has gone to the meetings of the Revolutionary Union, and they're very excited, and they send this to J. Edgar Hoover, and J. Edgar Hoover is very excited. He says, okay, quick, we're going to, you know, put this on a, you know, expedited scrutiny. We need to verify that this guy is for real because we can't just rely on one person's word for this. And, you know, but meanwhile, we need to put everybody he's come in contact with on this security index, which is the roundup list if there's a national emergency. So, you know, this was a real group, and the FBI was kind of, they had an opening and they jumped on it. I mean, the example, you know, you give, you know, there's a lot of cases. This is like a method of operation of the FBI. There's a lot of these quote unquote stings. And I you know, somebody ought to analyze it because there's, you know, or quantify it for one, but they ought to analyze, you know, why is this particular thing keep happening when it seems like the Bureau's mission is actually to, you know, chase down actually real and emerging threats, but it seems like there's a tendency for them to kind of create a threat and then stomp it down. And you know, I don't quite know what it all means.
Logic makes more sense when it comes to terrorist groups, but if you're talking about being involved in the formation of a long-term political group, I don't see what the upside is in helping that institution come into existence or keeping it. I mean, I understand why you want to keep it under, you know, keep your eye on it and get as close to it as you can. But did they ever worry about, you know, being the very source of their own problems when they would get involved with these organizations?
Well, I think the fact is these groups had initiative and they had, you know, and they were relatively ascendant. I mean, a very good example of the thing we discovered in our book was this entity called the Ad Hoc Committee. You know, the Communist Party in the early 1960s was extremely diminished. It was a few thousand cadre, you know, and it had kind of taken it on the chin, but the Bureau was not relenting. I mean, because the Soviet Union still existed and, you know, the potential for the Communist Party to grow again was probably close in their mind. It had grown, it had shrunk. So what they did is they actually created a whole cloth organization to try to disrupt the Communist Party, you know, and it was called the Ad Hoc Committee. And we're still learning things about it. I don't even know if at the beginning there were actual people in it. An FBI agent actually wrote newsletters claiming to be a pro-Maoist position. And they circulated it, you know, surreptitiously within the Communist Party to create dissension. And, you know, they actually created a situation where a number of people were expelled from the party because they read these bulletins and they liked what they read, you know, arguments pro-China when the Communist Party was pro-Soviet Union amid the Sino-Soviet split. The FBI was in there trying to break this group apart. They didn't want it to exist at all. So in that sense, I don't think it's so much they were creating a force that then had a life of its own. They were very keyed toward stopping these things. You know, all their efforts were aimed at that. You know, did it kind of go off track at times? I don't know. I mean,
So the flip side of my question is, what kinds of tactics did they use? You just named one of them to control these organizations that they were sometimes within the leadership of. What was their? I mean, their final aim would be to disband these organizations, right?
Yeah, disband, humiliate, make them break up, or you know, or arrest people. You know, whatever.
If they could get them to be criminal, then that would be perfect because then they could arrest them. But if they can't get them to be criminal, then they would have to just demoralize them and break the groups apart.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we learn, we start out writing about Students for Democratic Society, which, you know, in the mid to late 60s, it had approached 100,000 people.
Yeah, that were
part of this group. Yeah, I mean, it was all over the place, and everybody was welcome. And you know, but it's like if you wanted to, you know, be against the war, if you wanted to be for civil rights, if you wanted to, you know, be standing for a better world, you joined SDS. And the Bureau, as a matter of doctrine and method, tried to seize on every division and, you know, exacerbate, you know, differences. And the big thing they did was there were these two forces who were kind of, you know, at the close to the top of the group. There was the Progressive Labor Party, which was a pro-Maoist group started by some old Communist Party guys. And there was the Revolutionary Union, which was just starting out. And they literally took the Revolutionary Union's official documents, which were attacks on progressive labor, polemics. Mm-hmm. And they sent them to Progressive Labor, which kind of makes one examine polemics a bit differently. So the RU is writing these polemics. and the FBI is mailing it to PL to piss them off and to get these two groups at each other. And then they went to the Chicago Tribune where they had a friendly reporter, and they gave him a story saying, oh, the Revolutionary Union is going to try to take over leadership of SDS. And that article ran the day before the June 1969 article. SDS was in turmoil, as it was. People didn't know what direction they were going to take. Progressive labor wanted to more dominate things. The national office, which would become the Weathermen, wanted to take things in a more radical direction. And then here comes the Chicago Tribune article claiming this group of 20 to 24 people was going to try to take it over. And it, you know, it upset people. It confused people. It made people angry. And the Bureau is the one who did this story. It's my view SDS, you know, resolved itself the way it did because the differences existed. But the fact that the FBI was in there, you know, pushing for a certain thing is that, you know, they're part of the story, and that story needs to be told.
Yeah. Was it true? Was the FBI just giving a tip that was based on real intel, or was that completely a fabrication?
Well, I don't think the RU could take over the group organizationally unless they had a base of support in SDS. Did they want to control it? I think they wanted to have a very strong voice. Bob Avakian actually did run for an interim committee position. He actually won an interim committee position, but he was running for higher office. So, yeah, I mean, I think they had aspirations to have a big influence. I think the FBI seized on, you know, particles of truth and, exaggerated it, you know, toward their aims of creating more friction and division.
So how did you find these things out? I mean, these are new revelations. They sound familiar because, you know, others have come before you that have revealed similar things. But how did you find these things out, and how much more is out there to find out?
I think there's a lot more out there. I mean, this particular thing on SDS was we got the Chicago – we asked for some Chicago Tribune files, which corroborated some things. So that filled in some pieces. We discovered that the FBI had instructed its informants, and they had an informant in every major SDS chapter, multiple informants. They instructed their informants to vote with the national office against progressive labor because they didn't want PL to take over, because PL, they felt, was more organized and probably would, you know, create a more long-term strategic threat. So they actually instructed their informants to vote with the national office. We found a document by searching stuff the FBI had already released. Actually, in talking with a professor in Maryland, Art Eckstein, he kind of caught this, this clause where they say, oh, we should have our informants vote with the national office. But so, you know, one thing leads to another. There's a lot of documents that are just out there. They're there right now. And if you read them a certain way, you're going to discover some things. Other documents you need to ask for. Others, like the ad hoc committee, there's 15,000 to 17,000 pages that we requested. And we are being told that initially they said it's going to take years. And then we were told by the National Archives that they couldn't be released because they would reveal sensitive techniques. We're following that up, and we have another pending request. So, you know, we will see where it all leads. But there's things out there. And, you know, the thing is it's not just history. It is history, and it's fascinating, and I'm a historian. And, you know, if it were just this, that would almost be enough to keep me going. But, you know, there is a thing, I think, for people who are out in the world and maybe, you know, trying to do some good and confronting the powers that be, as it were, in the course of doing it. There is a thing where tried and true methods do tend to get adopted. I mean, maybe it's the FBI doing this thing today, or maybe it's a private security firm, or maybe it's another agent. But if methods have worked well in the past, they tend to get passed down and they tend to get refined. So I think there's things in our book that, you know, I think if you read it and study it, you know, it might help you understand the world you're living in, even though it's talking about, you know, a time that's now decades in the past.
You know, I tend to think that today, some of the work that informants would do and plants would do is just being done by crews of people who are, you know, surveilling the internet. That a lot more information is just readily available to the intelligence community because it's going on online and they're harvesting it all. But what they can't do that through the use of computers is get the kind of personal influence that probably these old FBI informants had in these organizations back in the day.
Well, I think that's an important point. I mean, there's, you know, the period we talk about, the main technology that was being dispatched were things like electronic surveillance, phone taps. I mean, they did have some use of closed circuit televisions. There was no internet. There were break-ins, you know, where called black bag jobs, where they would go in and, you know, go through people's files. But the most impressive thing to me was the level of informant penetration. And just from studying this this realm, it is my sense that there is no replacement for what they call human intelligence. I mean, there's a lot you can find out on the internet. There's a lot you can find out by listening to somebody's phone conversation or reading their email. But there are elements that you just are not going to know unless you have somebody in the organization who's insinuated themselves in. And especially if you have somebody who's at the top of the organization, you are going to have a much better picture of the group than probably most of the rank and file members. And that was my sense of the RURCP, that the FBI had a much better sense of the organization than most of the rank and file members as a result of what they were able to do with informants.
Yeah. Well, here's, this question is a sensitive one, and you can choose to keep it off the record if you want, or, but you were in some way or another involved in with Bob Avakian, and so you're involved in the RCP. Have you found out, or did you find out earlier that people that you might have thought of as comrades or good friends from those days, that one or two of them were informants?
No, nobody I met, which is not to say it's not true. It's just there's no evidence of that. On the other hand, there is, you know, we did discover evidence of people who were on the National Central Committee. I mean, at first we only discovered one person, but we've since got documents that have established that by 1971, the Bureau had two agents reporting on the National Central Committee. I mean, we've got notes of a Central Committee meeting, and there's two different versions because there's two different agents reporting. So no, I didn't know anybody personally, which is mainly just a matter of ignorance at this point.
Yeah.
But it's, what's more disconcerting is, you know, having worked, you know, fairly closely with this group for quite a long time, is to discover how naive, you know, I was you know, to not give the devil his due, as it were, that the Bureau really did have a very good picture. I mean, you know, when you're on the Central Committee of a group like the Revolutionary Communist Party, not having knowledge of all of how that works, but my sense is you're going to know a lot of things. You're not going to know everything, but, you know, with that position and then putting that together with the lower informants, you know, people anywhere from people who are in these more mass-based organizations, like they had this group, the Unemployed Workers Organizing Committee, which I did work with, and I do recall we had many strange characters kind of come in and out. You know, so you put those people's view, and, you know, at every level you've got informants reporting. You know, when you take all those reports and you put it into a binder, you have a pretty good picture, certainly a much better picture than I ever had of what was going on. It's sobering, and, you know, it argues for a lot of humility in the face of what the secret police are able to do. Not paralysis, but humility.
How aware of the infiltration were people? I mean, you say you were naive, but there was some inkling that people had that they were infiltrated or that the FBI might be hanging around even at the time, wasn't there?
Well, you know, it's a good question because, I mean, the thing is you know, kind of having bounced around the left a fair amount, everybody's got their theories on how this stuff works, you know, and how the FBI, et cetera, operate. And, you know, I think a lot of what people think is correct. Some of it I think is fantastic and a little exaggerated. But I think what our book does is tries to be, you know, somewhat disinterested in this and tries to just kind of say it as it is. You know, there's actual value to this is what we discovered in, you know, we can't set, and I'm certainly not going to say I have any idea of how you recognize this or how you know, navigate it and stuff. But I think if you read our book, you can get a sense of how it worked in a particular time, in a particular place, and in the context that tried and true methods tend to be passed on and adopted. I think there's some real value. I think a lot more work needs to be done. I know when I, you know, some of the books that I really appreciated, you know, reading were people like Frank Donner's work on the FBI, even, excuse me, Ward Churchill's book on the FBI and the Black Panthers, even though, you know, some of it I don't quite agree with. Mm-hmm. But these are helpful things. They document this is how it goes. And, you know, a good understanding of that versus theories or kind of catch-all, you know, global, you know, judgments on this, you know, actually knowing how it worked is better.
When I was involved in the peace movement way back in 2001, 2002, we all kind of speculated that the organization we were in was probably infiltrated by either local police or FBI or Homeland Security. And the final conclusion that we drew from all that was we had to behave as if that wasn't the case, that there was no way. All it could do was bring on paranoia to think about it. Was that kind of the modus operandi for people at the time back in the
day? Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, people need to kind of proceed from what they believe is right and just and true and go from there.
I'm asking you, do you remember how people talked about this problem now that you know a lot more about it now? You actually know what was going on now, but at the time, if you knew anything about it, it was only a suspicion. And I'm just wondering.
Well, yeah, anybody who's been active in any kind of organization on the left, and you know you, these are constant questions you have, and you know I think if you are reasonably sober, you try not to make yourself crazy, and you certainly don't. Actually, I watched an episode of The Sopranos. I mean, even Tony Soprano, before he, you know, targeted somebody because he thought he was a snitch, he went out and he got proof, you know, which is a funny thing, you know. Not that the mafia is any example to follow, but, you know, you don't make, you know, you don't do things unless you can prove it. But I think what's actually interesting is at the end of everything, the FBI did not stop this group from being created. It did not stop this group from being ascendant for a while to become a national organization. I think it applies to this group and many others. It's bigger forces propel these things forward. You know, the FBI is in there trying to, you know, intervene in a certain way, but they don't have all the initiative to make it go away. but they can certainly do damage. I mean, there is a dialectic. It's like to ignore, you know, the actual power and import of the secret or the political police is, you know, to lay yourself, would seem to lay yourself, you know, very vulnerable. But at the same time, it's, you know, there's a world out there that made people want to do things in the first place, and that's a big driving force. So it's kind of getting that dialectical interplay and, you know, to try to navigate that. But again, it's, you know, I'm kind of doing what I said I didn't want to do. I don't know what to tell people.
And some people say, yeah, well, okay, but how do we know that you won't be like others before you? How do we know you and your party won't be like the other groups that have come along in this country? How do we know that you won't sell out and revolution won't be betrayed, either before it even happens or after it, when you just try to turn it into your own thing for your own benefit? Turn it into your own thing for your own benefit. Turn it into your own thing for your own benefit. Turn it into your own thing for your own benefit. Turn it into your own thing for your own benefit. Turn it into your own thing for your own benefit. Do your own thing for your own benefit. Do your own thing for your own benefit. Do your own thing for your own benefit. 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 And some people say, yeah, well, okay, but how do we know that you won't be like others before you? How do we know you and your party won't be like the other groups that have come along in this country? How do we know that you won't sell out and revolution won't be betrayed, either before it even happens or after it, when you just try to turn it into your own thing for your own benefit?
It's interesting. There's another book that your book is compared to. You compared your book to Brian Burroughs' Days of Rage.
Brian Burroughs was, you know, I read his book, and I got to tell you, I learned a lot. I mean, it's a good overview of a bunch of groups that turned to essentially to political violence in the 70s. I mean, and, you know, some of it I found very interesting, very readable, and very informative. But he opens up by saying, look, I didn't even bother to try to get FBI files because most of what you get is dreck. And that just seems to me like, well, you know, you're kind of then just letting other people tell your story. I mean, he pulled his whole thing from secondary sources, and then he interviewed some people. He interviewed some former people who were in these groups, and he interviewed law enforcement, but he didn't look at any of these documents. I mean, and I contrast that with what we discovered when we got this original informants file. You know, when we set out to write our book, we didn't know how the Revolutionary Union was formed. You know, a couple of the key people who were instrumental in that have died. Others didn't want to really discuss it with us. But then we found these informant reports, these single-spaced 10, 12-page reports over a series of several months, and we began to get a picture, not to say everything in there was true, but we began to learn something that just didn't exist. I mean, kind of the historian craft, you do have to rely on these documents. And I think Burroughs didn't do that. And then, you know, he has kind of a very superficial take on who these groups were and why they were. I mean, he talks about their politics to a degree, but he doesn't quite plumb the depth of why these folks were moved to do what they did. I mean, I disagree with, you know, those groups, you know, their tactics and such, but I do kind of appreciate, you know, where they came from, where the, you know, what the world was that produced them. And I didn't get as deep a sense from him about that. But I just feel like there's much more to be told. We've done some Freedom of Information requests that kind of overlap, you know, with some of the groups. And, you know, the initial indication is nobody's ever asked for some of these records. And if you haven't seen them, you can't really pass judgment. Hey, maybe they are all dreck. Maybe there's nothing there. It's not been our experience so far. I suspect there's another Weatherman book to be written has a lot more. I know some people are actually working on some stuff. This Professor Art Eckstein is coming out with a book, which I think is more based on documents, which I'm curious to see, you know, what his take on it is. And, you know, hopefully other people are doing some things as well.
Who have you found who's most interested in understanding this, and what's the reaction been on the left or in general?
You know, we've got a pretty good reaction, and I think we have to do quite a bit more work to reach more people. You know, so far, look, there are people who don't like what we have to say, and they generally don't like it for partisan reasons, not necessarily politically partisan, but, you know, we've gotten an array of criticisms on what we had to say, from, you know, we're wrong to disparage the politics of this group, to we're wrong to, you know, not say Mao is a monster every time we say Mao Zedong. So there's that. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, people who had an association with this group, and there were a lot of them, I mean, there weren't millions, but there were thousands. Generally, everybody really, you know, they're very excited by the book. They're excited to read about something they were part of, and they feel like it's a rather sober accounting of that experience. I think they don't agree with perhaps everything in our analysis, but generally they were very receptive. What's interesting is we're finding a lot of young people who really like the book. You know, there's this one group down in a city down south who've been passing it around and studying it to kind of get a better sense of the new communist movement. And then there are, you know, to the degree we've gotten it out to some professors and stuff, I mean, it comes through in the blurbs on the book. It's, you know, there's an appreciation for us having done some, you know, rather extensive research into an area that hasn't been researched. So, you know, I'm actually pretty happy with the response. And, you know, it's been a lot of fun going to these book events and talking about this. And then people have all kinds of questions after, and they buy the book. And that's kind of what it's all about. That's why we wrote it. We think this is something worth spending some time, you know, spending several hours reading and getting familiar with an area that seems like maybe it's not important. But once you get into it, it actually does have some importance.
Yeah, you were a very involved activist for many, many years. But when would you say you stopped being kind of an on-the-ground activist?
Well, you know, in the mid-aughts, I stopped, and I've really kind of, you know, I just feel like the world today isn't going to see all the dreams maybe I had get realized in my lifetime. I have a sense that history moves a bit more glacially. Yes, there are moments when it moves rather rapidly. I was lucky enough to have caught the tail end of the 60s and see that excitement. You know, there's still very interesting and important things going on, and I'm connected to the world. But I don't think a stage-managed change is actually what's called for. I'm not quite sure what is called for. I'll get back to you on that.
Okay, well, I didn't even ask the question. I just asked when you stopped. But you anticipated my question, which was, do you see anything like what you saw in the late 60s in the world today? Where would you point to if you're going to point to the equivalent of the RCP? Does such a movement exist today?
No, I don't think it does. It's funny because I think there's, my sense is the left here, I might have said this the last time I discussed it, the left is very big in the United States, and it's also very, you know, all over the place. Everybody's got their pulling for a particular direction and such. So it's huge, and there's, you know, a level of sophistication that didn't exist. You know, there's, you know, a multitude of good things going on, but at the end of everything, the world sets the stage about what's possible. And right now, and this could change, and perhaps it could change quickly, but right now I don't see something like that. I have a big question. You know, the book I want to write that I may never write would be the one that anticipates what communism might actually look like. You know, I think people need to, I think we may have discussed this some before. You know, people need to envision what a world of freely associated human beings would look like. And you actually have to have a vision of that world to help you get to it. But you also need, you know, a different level of technology and production, and, you know, some basic problems of existence need to be resolved. So, you know, but it would be a good book. I want to read what that looks like, because I think people need to have that in mind. I think people do need to dream.